The principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Dr. George Christie is a professor of law at Duke University and a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center. Dr. Christie is a graduate of Columbia and Harvard Universities, and he's held Ford Foundation and Fulbright scholarships. He's taught law at the universities of Minnesota, Michigan, Florida, and North Carolina. Christie is the author of several books and numerous articles on a wide variety of legal subjects, including work on investment law, defamation, government surveillance, jurisprudence, privacy, and personal and institutional rights. Christie recently visited South Africa to lecture to several groups of law students and faculty. Dr. Christie, welcome to the National Humanities Center and to our radio program, Soundings. Joining in our discussion will be John Agresto, a staff member here at the center. I suppose the big question with regard to South Africa right now has to do with racial violence in that country. Is race war in South Africa inevitable?
Being in South Africa, I suppose I'm more pessimistic than I had otherwise been about the possibility of avoiding bloodshed. Whether it would be full-scale race war, that's another question. And what the time frame is in which violence will appear, that also is another question. I think we have to ask ourselves, where is South Africa now and where is it likely to get if we're going to try to answer the question about race war? From the economic point of view, apartheid is not working. It's proved impossible to have separate development. The whites need the black labor, and the black homelands are not viable without the resources which can be provided only by the white community. Now, as you know, there's been a great deal of improvement, particularly of the lot of the urban blacks and of the colored peoples, because of the great economic advancement which has taken place in South Africa. And indeed, on the economic front, many of the most horrendous aspects of apartheid are starting to break down. There are fewer job reservations. The government is at least accepting the notion of equal pay for equal work. Urban life sees fewer and fewer of the more petty aspects of apartheid, such as separate lines in post offices. The parks in most of the major cities are now integrated. One can go on and on along that line. And as I said, the economic situation in South Africa really requires the upgrading of non-white labor. Under the theory of apartheid, every black was assigned to a homeland, and as his homeland became independent, he would lose his citizenship in South Africa. But as we noted, apartheid just hasn't worked because of the need for black labor. After the Soweto riots in 1976, the government gave some greater security to urban blacks who were living in Soweto, allowing people to at least have 99-year leases on their property so that they could build houses and what have you. it appears that the government is prepared to grant more security to the urban blacks. That is, diminish the possibilities of being just dragged off and sent back to the homelands, the way the migrant laborers can be if they ever run afoul of the authorities. Giving the children of urban blacks the right to live in an urban environment instead of being forced to go back to the homeland.
Professor Christie, would changing these sort of conditions of life, are they substantial enough to head off what we were talking about a minute ago, the possibility of violent conflict?
No, actually, that's the point. As the economic situation improves, mm-hmm. although it relieves some pressure in the short run, in the long run, it obviously accentuates the political problem. As people get more and more economic rights, the disparity between their economic rights and their political rights, of course, gets to be even unbearable, particularly for the more educated. And there is the beginnings of a black and colored middle class, a professional class, even lawyers, doctors, and what have you, being developed in South Africa.
Is there anything being done on the political level to integrate political power into the whole of the community?
Well, what the South Africans are trying to do is, first of all, co-opt, if they can, the Asian and colored communities. South Africa is really composed of four racial groups. There's the whites, who are about 4.5 million, the Asians, who are some 800,000, the Cape Coloreds, who are close to 2.5 million, and then, of course, there are the blacks, some 19 million of them, broken up into a number of tribal groups, of whom the Zulus and Xhosa, with about 5 million members apiece, are the two largest groups. Now, with regard to the Asians and the Cape Coloreds, who are truly South Africans according to South African law, although they are prevented from living in white areas and are subject to segregation, nonetheless, they've always been treated as South African citizens. There was no thought of putting these people in their own, quote, separate homelands. The government is trying, through what is called the President's Council, to give these people some type of representation which is outside of Parliament, but nonetheless tries to bring in the leaders of these communities into the periphery, at any rate, of South African political life. Frankly, I don't think that will be successful, but the government is trying to do something in that score.
Professor Christie, how does South Africa get into this fix?
Well, you might say it was almost born in it, but looking at modern South Africa, the Treaty of Peace in 1903 between the British and the Boers contains many of the seeds of the present deplorable situation in South Africa. In that treaty, the British agreed that no decision would be made with regard to the representation of the non-white communities in the legislatures of the Transvaal and the old Orange Free State until after those colonies had again received self-government from the British. This was part of the surrender terms. This was deplorable because one of the ostensible reasons that the British gave for getting into the Boer War was the disgraceful treatment of the non-white populations by the Boer republics. And yet here in the Treaty of Peace, they were already conceding one of the major points. Well, obviously, deferring the issue of non-white representation until self-government meant, of course, no non-white representation. When the Union was established in 1909-1910, the British South Africa Act accepted that no non-whites could be elected to the Union Parliament, even though in Cape Province it had been possible for non-whites to be elected to the legislature. The Boer War also accentuated the divisions among the white community between the English-speaking whites and the majority Afrikaans-speaking whites. So that obviously had an important effect.
Professor Christie, you're an attorney. You teach law. And one of the intriguing elements in this whole situation is the difference between the law of South Africa and the authority, the way the law gets carried out.
The major problem, I think, in South Africa today is that there is no effective parliamentary opposition. The nationalists control roughly 80% of the seats in the House of Assembly, which is the lower house of the South African parliament. As a result, the government can do practically anything it wishes by legislation. It also is not embarrassed very much by parliamentary questions. As a consequence, the government has become, or the South African regime has really become, an administrative state. It is a large bureaucracy which administers the apartheid system. The system works partly because it is possible to get a permit which ignores the legal prohibitions which have been set up to protect apartheid. To give you an example, in 1959, when the South African universities were segregated as a matter of law, prior to that, some universities in South Africa had open admissions policies. Well, in 1959, the government closed the universities to members of the different races. The white universities could only have white students. The fact is, however, when it is illegal for non-whites to be in white institutions, there is now a larger percentage of non-white students at the University of the Witwatersrand, where I lectured, and at Cape Town, where I also gave some lectures, than there were in 1959. Why is that? Because of permits. The system, you see, is ostensibly so inflexible that it can't work. And for that reason, it is possible to get permits to do a great many things. People even get administratively reclassified as white, for example. That has been done, although the government does not want to advertise that it's engaged in this sort of thing. So that makes it sort of an administrative state. There are also large areas of government in which the ministerial authority can be exercised adverse to the individual, with regard, for example, to banning of people because they're presumed to be either communists or because they're engaging in certain prohibited types of political activity. Ministerial discretion is practically unchecked. Also, with regard to the banning of publications, either on regard of obscenity or because of political ramifications.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
Dr. George Christie is a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, and he's a professor of law at Duke University. Christie has written widely on numerous legal topics, and he's participated in symposia under the auspices of the American Bar Association on American relations with China and the Soviet Union. Christie is also an observer of South Africa, where he visited recently at the invitation of South African law students and faculty. Joining in our discussion of South African politics and society is John Agresto, a staff member at the National Humanities Center.
What has the United Nations, the world community, individual nations, what has been their policy? Obviously, South Africa has been, in a sense, a pariah in the world community. But what's been the policy of nations? Has it had any domestic internal effect on South Africa? And as a person who's been there and studied it, what do you think the international policy should be? I guess it's a three-point question.
Well, most countries, of course, have expressed their disapproval, as I think they ought to, of the way in which South Africa has developed. Now, does that disapproval have any kind of effect on South Africa? And I think the answer to that point is yes, up to a point. By that I mean, I think the South Africans are acutely aware of the disapproval of educated and intelligent people in the world community. And because of that, I think it does have some influence on what their policies are. If, however, the international community attempts to put what the South Africans feel is extreme pressure upon them, such as to totally break with them with regard to having diplomatic relations, total economic boycott, and what have you, then I think the international community will lose whatever leverage it might have over the internal South African situation.
So you're saying that moral sanctions seem to be, in a sense, even more effective and efficacious than real economic sanctions would be?
Well, they certainly would be more efficacious, because you can't ignore the fact that South Africa is one of the richest countries in the world. And indeed, so long as inflation continues in the Western world, and it seems as if it's going to continue for the foreseeable future, the South Africans really have a printing press, which enables them to print money as they need it, because the price of gold just goes up and up and up. That being the case, there's really almost nothing you can do economically to hurt them. You know, if you could be sure that a boycott would bring the present South African regime down in 4, 5, or 10 years, then it might be possible to support such a boycott. But the point is, the South African regime is not going to be brought down in 5 or 10 or 15 or even 20 years, not in my view. To limit South Africa's economic development will just make the plight of these non-whites worse. Now, there's a sharp division of opinions, certainly in South Africa, as there is here, among non-white members of the community. Most of the blacks that I spoke to in South Africa were opposed to boycotts because of the economic effect it would have on them. And yet, I, to be honest, there are a number of South African blacks who, of course, are very much in favor of some type of economic boycott on the part of the West and the Western world.
What does the election of Ronald Reagan mean for South Africa, or for the relationship between the United States and South Africa?
Frankly, I think nothing. I think the U.S. policies remain the same. Reagan is not about to embrace apartheid. I think U.S. policies with South Africa have been fairly consistent over time and will continue to be so. I think the rhetoric, though, will change. That's clear. The South Africans really know that they have the tiger by the tail. They realize that in the long run, violence is a very great possibility. They realize also that from the economic point of view, it is possible to move to a more integrated type of society, and to some extent, economic necessity is forcing them to do so. The $64 question is the political one. The problem the government has is that it can't see any kind of viable solution that it can try to sell to its supporters. For example, in Johannesburg and in Pretoria, the parks, as I said, are fully integrated, even though some of the extreme right-wing African nationalists think that that's an abandonment of the policies of the government. The government has also announced that it is prepared to move to abolish the Mixed Marriages Act, which prohibits marriages among or between members of different races. So the government wants to move, although it's subject to the constraints of its right wing, but to return to what I started saying, they don't know where to move to. I think they're aware that if you go to one man, one vote, and everybody accepts this, certainly the blacks in South Africa that I spoke to seem to be prepared to accept it as well, the country will probably move towards a black authoritarian regime. The economic disparities in the country are too great. There are tribal differences. It is unlikely that democracy in the Western sense could survive a one man, one vote pattern. What could be done to try to move towards political integration and yet preserve some of the trappings of Western democracy. Well, one thought that has attracted some people is some method whereby each racial group has a number of representatives whom it votes for to a comprehensive parliament. In that way, each racial group is guaranteed of some representation in the national legislature, and through this kind of composite, so to speak, the Western-style democracy and parliamentary government can be preserved.
Professor Christie, what's the role of lawyers, and especially what's the role of courts and judges in this kind of a society?
The South Africans still have an independent judiciary. To that extent, South Africa is an authoritarian state, but it is not a totalitarian state. The courts are truly independent of the government. Their jurisdiction has been eroded by the government, which has removed many issues which in other countries would go to the courts, and has made these issues matters of administrative determination. But the courts themselves are still independent. And that's why lawyers can, up to a point, serve a useful purpose in South Africa, and do serve useful purposes, by forcing the government to at least follow its own procedures, by catching the government up in its contradictions. Because the courts will, in those circumstances, give relief. Admittedly, it's only relief in individual cases, but it is one way of making the system more humane. And it stresses the significance of the legal profession. Now, cynics will say that the reason for this is that the government thinks it is good public relations, vis-a-vis the rest of the world, to have an independent judiciary, and to preserve the legal profession as a possible buffer against some of the excesses of the administrative state.
Is the legal system that you're describing in South Africa possibly an avenue toward the solution of the problems that we've been discussing?
Only in a minor sort of way. I mean, one thing that the South Africans got from the British was the notion of parliamentary supremacy. And so the courts are not about to challenge the vast block of legislation which is on the books. What you can hope that the courts will do, and occasionally they do it, although they have been increasingly criticized now for being unimaginative, is to ameliorate the operation of the law, because Roman Dutch law, as the English common law, has certain maxims which favor reasonableness in the interpretation of any kind of legislation. It's also a maxim of Roman Dutch law that that law should treat people equally, unless the legislature has specifically insisted that equality of treatment is not to be accorded. Finally, some friends of mine in South Africa are trying to get the South African courts to recognize the defense of necessity when people are punished because they are living in areas reserved for another race, the defense of necessity being that there's no adequate housing available in the areas reserved for their own race, and therefore, in order to preserve the life and health of their families, they're obliged to seek accommodation where it's obtainable. So there are small ways in which the law can attempt to be sort of a buffer between the excesses of the regime and the population that is subject to the regime. But that's about all you can expect. Major changes will have to be legislative. That's clear.
Professor Christie, what is life like in South Africa? You've visited there and moved among the people.
Life is good, certainly for the white people. Life is good. Reminds one of some English provincial towns, at least in the English-speaking parts of South Africa. It's safe. Johannesburg is probably safer than New York, despite the racial tensions, which do exist. One notices no real hostility on the part of blacks with whom one deals. As I said, there is a rising black middle class, and I met a number of black professionals in Johannesburg who took me to Soweto and took me into people's houses and took me to shopkeepers whom I spoke to. And to be quite honest, I've seen parts of the United States, even here in Durham, North Carolina, where I live, in New York City, where I grew up, that were worse and are still worse than anything in Soweto. The problem with Soweto is that people are forced to live there. That's what's terrifying about it. And that is a frightening thing. One has no words really to describe it. But as far as the material aspects of it go, there are many worse areas, as I said, in this country. Clearly, that's so. I think the government still has a residue of goodwill on the part of all members of the South African society, which it can lay claim to, if it could finally resolve the issue as to where it wants to go. But the Afrikaners, who ruled now for so long, and since 48, when the Nationalists came into power, the Afrikaners have really been the predominant group on the South African political scene. The thought of going from being the dominant group in society to being just one of many groups in society is a very, very difficult pill for them to swallow. Particularly since, unlike the English people up in Zimbabwe, old Southern Rhodesia, the Afrikaners really have no place to go if they don't like it. These people have been in South Africa for over 300 years. And I say the thought of going back to being a minority in a country which they feel that they've developed and are certainly politically dominated, and which they fought for in their several wars against the British, is a very, very terrifying thought indeed, although they will have to move in that direction.
If you had to put the future of South Africa in a nutshell, if you had to say, looking in the future 5, 10, 15 years, make some predictions or some projections for us.
You know, I spoke to a lot of people, Afrikaners and English, and black and colored, when I was in South Africa, and asked them that question, what does the future have? And there is no consensus. You could have violence. Probably in the long run you will have violence if there's no change. You know, being a South African, you know, is like being an American. There are lots of people who are patriots, who believe in their country, even if they disapprove of its policies. Their fathers and grandfathers have spilt their blood in that country. And if push comes to shove, these people may rally around the flag.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Bill Bennett, Director of the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, inviting you to listen this week for Soundings, the radio program of the National Humanities Center. This week, Soundings presents an illuminating overview of South Africa, its society, its law, its politics, and its race relations, in a conversation with Professor George Christie, a scholar in residence at the center and an incisive observer of South Africa today. Listen this week for Soundings.